On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Mitt Romney takes Florida. Breast cancer giant Komen cuts funding to Planned Parenthood. 8.3% unemployment now. And Facebook files for a giant IPO. Mitt Romney felt it coming. He was singing in Florida even before the vote.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain. For purple mountains.
Yeah, Susan G. Komen for The Cure made headlines all over when it cut funds to Planned Parenthood and put itself in the family planning debate. Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier urged women to take their complaints to the Komen Foundation.
Tell them that you want them to stick to what they know. Let's not make this a race to the political bottom.
And tech giant Facebook files for an enormous public stock offering.
Wall Street is waiting with bated breath, and I think we all know why. Today, it is expected Facebook will file papers for its IPO, setting the stage for one of the biggest offerings in the history of internet companies.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Howard Fineman of the Huffington Post, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you say on the GOP after Florida? Mitt Romney and the poor Komen Planned Parenthood. Will you be a Facebook billionaire? What's your top story this week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. John McCormick joins us from Washington. He's a staff writer for the Weekly Standard. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Howard Fineman joins us from Washington. He's editorial director of the AOL Huffington Post Media Group. Sounds like a media baron. Howard, great to have you.
Well, I'm not a baron, but I'm glad to be with you.
Oh, a baronet. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Howard, and John.
Let's just dive straight into it. Mitt Romney was feeling pretty good when he won the Florida primary. Here he is in his victory speech in Tampa Tuesday night.
A competitive primary does not divide us. It prepares us, and we will win.
And we will win, looking pretty good. Next morning, CNN interview on the morning after that big Florida win. This comment, it described all week long as a gaffe in the media. He said that he was not concerned about the very poor.
I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90-95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
Okay, there's a kind of a nuanced message there, but right in the middle of it, that phrase, I'm not concerned about the very poor, and John McCormick, you wrote, Mitt Romney made the most stunningly stupid remark of his campaign. What's this about, John?
Well, I think it was a huge gaffe on two levels. One, I mean, it's just unbelievable that those words would come out of a politician's mouth, that he would say, I'm not concerned about the very poor. Now, clearly, you can say, my focus is the middle class, as Bill mm-hmm. Clinton always did, as most politicians always did, without saying, I'm not concerned about the very poor. You can say, my focus is the economy, without saying, I'm not concerned about education. So that was a gaffe, but I thought it went deeper than that, actually. When you heard him explain and justify his statement,
Soledad O'Brien right away said, wait a minute, what did you say there? And he kind of came back and said it again.
He did. And what he said was, well, if there are holes in this safety net, I'll fix it. But the safety net is what's there, and that's what's there to protect the poor. When the standard conservative argument for years has always been that the conservative economic agenda is designed to help everyone. It's designed to help lift people out of poverty, get them off food stamps, return Medicaid to the states so that they can be more flexible and adaptive in providing better care to those who will always have to rely on the safety net, even in good times. So I think it was really a failure both in style and in substance in what he said.
Newt Gingrich, watching and listening closely at a rally in Reno, where everything moves to Nevada on Wednesday, told his supporters that unlike Mitt Romney, he is concerned about all Americans, rich and poor.
I am fed up with politicians in either party dividing Americans against each other. I am running to be the president of all the American people, and I am concerned about all of the American people.
Newt, loves you all. Howard Fineman, let's start with Mitt. We'll come to Newt. What do you make of what Mitt Romney's trying to say, what he did say, how it's playing out, and this sort of
trail now of what's described as gaffes behind him. Is it a big deal or just, you know, chaff on the campaign trail?
Well, it's a big deal, and for another reason, which is that Mitt Romney has been caricatured as sort of a Richie Rich character who's out of touch with the American people generally, who understands how to send his money to the Cayman Islands to lower his tax rate, who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, who doesn't really understand the lives of average Americans. So it was against that background that these comments had such impact, I think. And also, they're one in a series of statements like this that he's made. I think it's partly because he wants to show what a tough guy he is and that he's a real free market conservative. So he says things like, let's let the mortgage crisis bottom out. Let's let people lose their homes so we can begin building back.
Big two-fisted conservative.
Yeah, big two-fisted conservative. And because he doesn't get the music of politics, because he really doesn't feel it, he doesn't see the danger signs out there when he does something like this. And it's happened repeatedly, and it's going to happen again anytime he isn't reading from a teleprompter.
Oh, there's the Republican line on Obama. Jack, yes. Beatty, a big win this week for Romney, though, and he's got all the momentum out of that, or had it, probably still has it, I don't know. What about the Mitt Romney and the music of politics and the facts of politics? Are they different, Jack?
I think they are. And, you know, I think in the cable verse, we can all make a lot of these things and perhaps too much of them, out of them. This election probably will be decided, as the 2004 election was by 60,000 votes in Ohio or Florida. Those folks who are going to decide the election aren't paying attention to any of this. They're going to turn on the television set around Labor Day, and they're going to see two candidates, one a plausible, a successful businessman, an incumbent president with an economic record. And all of this stuff, I don't think, is going to matter to them very much. And also, this has obscured what we've just seen over the last week. Mitt Romney came out of South Carolina with challenges. He had terrible debate performances. He hired a debate coach to show him how to do it. He won the debates in Florida. He had laid back in South Carolina off Newt and attacked the president. Didn't make that mistake in Florida. Spent, you know, 98% of his ads were negative in Florida against Newt. He was uncomfortable with his wealth in South Carolina, kind of like bashful about it. And boy, he got on the stage in those debates. He said, "I'm a rich guy, and I am proud of it." The point is, that's pragmatic deal, you know, that.
And
that
he won. That plus, what, $15 million on ads, but altogether he won.
He won. And I think this talk, you know, the back and forth about his gaffes, which are there, shouldn't obscure his adaptability and the adaptability of that machine he's got.
John McCormick, I want to come to you on that. But first, here's the president. Now, without naming Mitt Romney, he kind of came back in on this. This was at the National Prayer Breakfast yesterday. And the president saying that his Christian faith guides his tax policy. And then there was a kind of what would Jesus do moment, maybe with a reference to subliminal Romney and poverty.
If I'm willing to give something up as somebody who's been extraordinarily blessed and give up some of the tax breaks that I enjoy, I actually think that's going to make economic sense. But for me as a Christian, it also coincides with Jesus' teaching that for unto whom much is given, much shall be required.
Okay, John, you say the stupidest remark of his campaign so far in the comment on the poor, but what do you see coming? Is it going to be Romney, Obama? And what about that matchup?
I do think that Romney is still the odds-on favorite. You know, the conventional wisdom would say that he has about a 90% chance of winning the nomination. I might be a little bit more bold and say maybe just an 80% chance. But either way, I think that unless Romney can really have his momentum stopped and have this race come down to either him and Gingrich or him and Santorum, I think that he is the odds-on favorite. And I think that it's going to be a close race. As Jack Beatty said, it's probably going to be one of the closest elections in history, like 2004. It's going to come down to a state or two. I think that a lot will be determined by events. How much more does this economy improve? I think that we really just don't know, but I would expect a close race.
Howard Fineman, you're watching Newt Gingrich and listening very closely to him. People have talked about Ron Paul in a third-party challenge. But when Mitt started talking that night in Florida about, hey, you know, I'm beyond parties, I'm the guy for all the people, you heard a little possible third-party candidacy music in there, Howard.
Yeah, Newt was speaking. Yes, well, here's my take on Newt, having covered him for many years. A few things. First of all, the animosity toward Mitt Romney is real and deep and very personal. That's number one. Mm. Number two, Newt regards himself as a world historical figure, and going off into the sunset as a loser in the Republican primary season, which he's probably going to be, is not going to be enough to fill his imagination about himself. Mm-hmm. He's talked about running a people's campaign now, not a Republican, I think he said on election night in Florida. Okay, now I'm not just running a Republican campaign, I'm running a people's campaign. Some might point out that the people's campaign would start at your nearest Tiffany's store, but be that as it may, I think that it's going to be difficult for Mitt Romney to corral Newt Gingrich. I think one of the big stories of the later part of this season is going to be the diplomacy there. It's going to be what Newt does at the convention, and it's going to be whether Newt is on the team or not. Whether he runs on his own, who knows? It's difficult technically to do that. But I have a hard time seeing him standing on the stage arm in arm with Mitt Romney in Tampa in August. I think it's very unlikely.
Yeah, interesting. John, we've just got 20 seconds before the break. Can Mitt Romney corral Newt Gingrich? Can the GOP corral him? Does he spike Romney in the end?
When the race comes down to Obama and Romney or whoever the Republican is, the entire Republican Party will unite around him, including Newt Gingrich, I believe.
Howard Fineman may be betting the other way on the Newtmeister's sense of himself in history. We'll look at that and more. John McCormick with the Weekly Standard. Please stand by. Howard Fineman, it is great to have you with us from the Huffington Post. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. Romney out front again with a gaffe again on the poor. Komen cuts off Planned Parenthood. Political soccer riots in Egypt. Facebook lines up for a huge IPO. We're at 800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Mitt Romney, Komen, Planned Parenthood, soccer riots in Egypt, talk about Taliban, talk about an Israeli attack on Iran, and of course there's Facebook. And of course, it was Groundhog Day yesterday. Looks like we're in for six more weeks of winter. That's according to Punxsutawney Phil, the Pennsylvania groundhog who saw his shadow yesterday.
Phil proclaimed, as I look at the crowd on Gobbler's Knob, many shadows do I see. Six more weeks of winter, it must be.
The crowd on Gobbler's Knob. All right, Punxsutawney Phil, you can join the conversation today. What do you think? Has Romney found his feet, found his way? Where do these four take us now? Newt, Mitt, Rick, Ron, what about the gaffe? I'm not concerned about the very poor. And what's up with Komen and Planned Parenthood? Are you still walking for the pink after all this? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. Howard Fineman's with us from the Huffington Post today. He was in Miami this week covering the Florida primary. John McCormick's here from the Weekly Standard. Our own Jack Beatty's here. Erin in Iowa is weighing in online. She says, "Oh, Mitt, you forgot a verse from him singing at the top of the show. America, America, God shed his grace on thee till selfish gain no longer stain the banner of the free." You start singing any song, you never know where the lyrics are going to go. Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen a politician snatch defeat from the jaws of victory like Mitt Romney did this week. And then it just got worse when he tried to correct it. Yesterday, he was photographed shaking hands with Donald Trump and accepting his endorsement. And they might as well blow that up and make it a poster for the League of Extraordinarily Wealthy Gentlemen. And then today, he said, after he was chastised by Jim DeMint, of all people, he went back and said it was a misstatement, he misspoke. And he said, and I love this line, he said, "I've said something that is similar to that, but quite acceptable, for a long time." And the artifice behind that statement is amazing. I mean, it's kind of like Roseanne Barr saying, "Well, forget that time I botched the national anthem, because I once hit a note that was very similar to that and very acceptable once upon a time."
Hey, Mark, we've got it. I mean, Jack, everybody's pushing back here. I mean, even John McCormick, our, you know, sort of conservative guest today, says stunningly stupid remark. But you're saying, forget this stuff, it's okay. I mean, does the music matter here, Jack, maybe more than you're suggesting?
Perhaps so. I've just watched a fair, you know, over the years, I've watched these focus groups that C-SPAN runs. And when you watch them with undecided voters late in the campaign, it is clear these people haven't paid attention to any of this. Moreover, they think this is trivial. They think, look, what's your positions on the issue? What's your background? Are you plausible? Can we look at this debate proscenium and think, yeah, that's a president? They really don't want to be bothered with this. The people who will decide the election, I don't think, are paying attention. Now, we can say there's a narrative. Sure, there's a narrative, and it's not pleasant for Mitt Romney in this regard. And I think he did speak the truth. He doesn't. As Paul Krugman points out, he really doesn't care about the poor. He subscribes to the Ryan budget, and according to Krugman, that would drastically cut programs for the poor, cut Medicaid perhaps by as much as 40%. And he said he doesn't really think that the rich need any help. Well, then why is he proposing a tax cut that would mean a $4 million tax cut for himself? So, you know, he told the truth, at least, about the poor. Not really about the rich.
Howard Fineman, we've got sympathy coming in here online. Emmanuel Salinas writes on Facebook, you know, saying, come on, the middle class is in trouble. Romney's right. He says, leave Romney alone. He's on to something here, Howard.
Well, of course the middle class is in trouble, and of course he's on to something, but politics is about how you say things as well as what you say. And I disagree with Jack because I know that late deciding voters aren't paying attention to this. But the public character of candidates are formed in this season. And the image of Mitt Romney will be well formed and well decided upon by the time that those late deciding voters look at him. And if he's sort of indelibly marked as a gaffe-prone guy who only understands the lives of the rich, That message will be there as part of his character and part of his public persona when he steps on the stage with the debates, and it'll be up to him in the debates to try to disprove that. So things that happen now do matter later on, I think.
John McCormick, you're the guy who wrote the most stunningly stupid remark of his campaign. Is he you know, making cement shoes for himself here, John?
Well, if I could just jump in and respond to what Jack Beattie said mm-hmm. about how the Ryan budget is proof that Mitt Romney does not care about the poor. I disagree with that. I think that the Ryan budget is designed to help the poor. It's designed to help everyone. The poor are being threatened by this debt crisis that is facing us in the next decade or whoever knows when it might come. But as Paul Ryan says, when a debt crisis comes, the poor and the elderly are hit the first and the worst. And with Medicare left unchecked, with Medicaid without any reforms, these programs will go bankrupt and eventually the people that are currently on them will be hurt very badly. So we need to take steps now to reform them. I think that the way Mitt Romney answered is the problem. Again, it was the callous remark, I'm not concerned about the very poor. And then the explanation that, well, you know, the poor have this safety net and that's fine. He didn't, if it needs fixing, of course it needs fixing. We need fixing. We need conservative reforms. And I think that, you know, the Ryan plan, the conservative economic agenda is in the long run, ultimately in the best interest of the poor, getting them off of.
Jack, can I jump in on, I mean.
Sure. Howard, come on in.
On that? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree with John as far as he goes. However, even a non-flaming liberal such as Kent Conrad, who's after all a Democrat, I admit, but quite a conservative Democrat, said in introducing a discussion of the new budget outlook the other day that the revenue side is the main problem in terms of the deficit that John is talking about. I sympathize with the conservative argument about the size of government and all that, but revenues have to be part of the equation if we're going to save ourselves from the financial, from the fiscal catastrophe that John is talking about. And to the extent that the Republicans refuse to seriously discuss that, they can't be taken seriously on this question.
Right there, you get a preview of the debate to come in the summer and fall. Ted in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Ted, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of struck by the fact that Mitt Romney seems to be relatively weak, and that even if he does win the Republican nomination, that the risk of a third party kind of coming in and making some big waves seems pretty apparent. The thing that bothers me about the third party run, though, is that it seems that historically in the United States, there's at least been the precedent of, you know, threats to the union when that occurs. You know, 1860 obviously being the biggest example, but then even 1968 with George Wallace, you know, getting some fraction of the South, you kind of wonder, you know, if Mitt Romney wins the Republican nomination, he may still be, you know, be vulnerable to an attack from a third party who sweeps the South, and all of a sudden you have a sectional divide. Things we think about back in high school history classes, but I think hopefully something we won't have to see again in our lifetimes. And I'd like to get your callers, or at least your panel's response to that.
Yeah, Ted, thanks very much. John, what about you say the Republican Party will rally around Mitt Romney, but people are pointing to relatively low turnout in the primaries so far, and there are ardent, outspoken holdouts here. What about that kind of risk to the whole?
I think the greatest threat of a third party for someone like Mitt Romney is Ron Paul. You know, Paul has refused repeatedly to say that he would rule out running as a third party, though his son, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, said recently while they were campaigning in New Hampshire that this would be a bad idea. It would hand the election to Obama. The Tea Party is best off within the Republican Party. So I think for the sake of his son's political future alone, Ron Paul will stay out, will not have a third party. Now, there is another opportunity for a third party. Well, we know for a fact there's going to be this Americans Elect where people are going to nominate a candidate online. There's a lot of money behind this. They're actually going to get on all 50 ballots. You know, the question is, what do they get? Do they get a percentage point? Do they get 5%? Do they get 0.01%? That's a really an unknown.
Jack, I want to get to the economy, 8.3% unemployment, and to this whole Komen Planned Parenthood thing. But what about the threat to the whole that our caller sees?
Well, he's evoking the 1860 election when we had two Democratic parties, Stephen Douglas running in the northern one, John C. Breckinridge in the southern one, and yes, they divided. Now, is Newt the John C. Breckinridge of 2012? We don't know. I think, you know, I guess I'm inclined to agree with Howard. He's going to be very he's going to be churlish, won't even, it doesn't even begin to explain how he will deal with Romney. But I, in the end, I think he will stay within the tent, just simply because if he were to mount any kind of third party challenge, that would really doom the Republicans. And I think, I just can't imagine that he will go that far, but who knows? And also, you know, on Ron Paul, he has, and I think Howard has pointed this out repeatedly, he has practically been a wholly owned subsidiary of Mitt Romney throughout this whole business. Lots of cooperation between the campaigns, lots of good signals between them. I don't see him running against Mitt Romney.
We'll see. Economy up, down, or sideways. I mean, we've got this 8.3% unemployment. That is the lowest in a long time. And down again since last time. On the other hand, Ben Bernanke, chair of the Federal Reserve, before the House Budget Committee just yesterday, saying the economic recovery is happening but is frustratingly slow.
Over the past 2.5 years, the U.S. economy has been gradually recovering from a deep recession. While conditions have certainly improved over this period, the pace of the recovery has been frustratingly slow, particularly from the perspective of the millions of workers who remain unemployed or underemployed.
Okay, Howard Fineman, I mean, Labor Department says a 250,000 new jobs in January, 243,000, and 8.3% weirdly sounds pretty good to our ears after all those years of 9-plus. What do you see in the economy, Howard?
Well, I think those numbers are good, both substantively and politically for President Obama and for the Democrats. But they come against the background of a situation where in the polls, people still, by 2-to-1 margin, say the country's going in the wrong direction, and where people are still pretty gloomy about the economy overall. So politically, what the president needs is for this 250,000 job number to be repeated this month and every month leading up to the debate season in the fall. If he can do that, if he has a strong track record of job creation over those many months, it makes it an even closer race. Right now, I think the president is under 50-50 in terms of reelection chances if you look at the Electoral College. But if he can get 6-7 months worth of this kind of number, and this 250 number is an important number because I think it's at or better than the replacement amount that you need to in a growing economy, in a growing country, mm-hmm. and economy. Then that's going to help. That's going to help his argument that his policies have finally begun to take hold, and now is not the time to change them. It's a difficult argument to make, but that's the one he's going to have to make.
Let's go to our listeners, Mia in Boston. Thanks for calling, Mia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The biggest story for me this week has been the Komen story and Komen cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood, which, you know, as a consumer rights and women's health advocate, I think is super despicable, but I'm cautiously optimistic that all of the backlash and all of the conversation around Komen cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood will open up a new conversation that we can focus on prevention. There's been far too much focus on the elusive search for the cure and pink ribbons and pink washing, which is something that I've written about, the corporate use of the pink ribbon.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that we can focus a lot more on the environmental links to breast cancer and other illnesses that we can actually do something about. We can actually get some of these toxic chemicals off of the market, you know, out of consumer products and food and air and water, and reduce the instance of cancer in the first place.
Mia, let me ask you, I mean, that's a big project. The environment is big and all kinds of stuff in it. Talk about long-term. I mean, cure is challenging. They're both challenging. Is that a roundabout way of saying that you're now against women supporting Komen? They've poured a lot of money into work on this front.
Sure. I wouldn't go as far as saying that I'm against women doing anything that they feel that they need to do to raise awareness or find solidarity in this really important fight against breast cancer. So I wouldn't put the blame or the focus on women at all. I would redirect your question back to Komen, to Avon, to Estee Lauder, and these supposed nonprofits that have been raising unbelievable quantities of money in the name of the fight against breast cancer, with putting almost no money into preventing breast cancer in the first place. You know, early detection is incredibly important. Would I love for there to be a cure for breast cancer? Absolutely. But when we look at the facts here, and we see so many chemicals linked to cancer on the market in the first place, and Komen actually supporting, you know, Promise Me fragrances perfume that has toxic chemicals in it, and Estee Lauder, you know, putting carcinogens and chemicals linked to hormone disruption in their cosmetics and then giving them to women with breast cancer through their Look Good, Feel Better program, it's what gets me up in the morning. It's very disturbing.
Mia, thank you for your call. We got it loud and clear. And, I mean, Howard, I mean, everybody. I mean, who's not for prevention? Who's not for a cure? But there's a big issue of resources here and a big step this week by Komen doing this. Howard, can you explain what happened? You know, what's going on here in the Komen, for the cure outfit? It is so big. It's all over the place. And this week it says it hasn't, but it appears to have taken a quite political step or principled step. I don't know how you want to describe it here. And it comes back to family planning, maybe back to abortion.
It does come back to those. And the way I see this is that it's the power of the conservative anti-abortion birth control and genetic manipulation issue. Out on the campaign trail, I attended a conference called the Personhood Conference. I don't even remember what state it was in. It was either Iowa or New Hampshire, in which conservatives, Catholics, and evangelicals primarily talked about the threat to humanity and morals in the ability of science to control human creation in terms of abortion, in terms of birth control, in terms of genetic research, and so forth. This is a very deep and emotional issue with conservative Catholics and with evangelicals. And they are making their views and their opinions known in the Republican Party. Every one of the Republican candidates except Mitt Romney showed up at this Personhood Conference, called Personhood because it was about the notion that a fetus from the moment of conception is a person. And I can't overstate the power of this issue among some people. And I think that's what the Komen Foundation was responding to, clearly. That's what why the Republicans are attacking Planned Parenthood the way they are. And the spillover effect of that affected the Susan G. Komen Foundation, which, after all, I think originally had Republican roots when it started, but has become this big national organization. But they're national, but they're politically sensitive. And that's what I think has driven this whole crisis.
John McCormick, we'll come back and look at this after the break, but what do you see in the Komen? Do you think they'll circle the wagons and stick with this position? They've got fresh support coming in from pro-life, anti-abortion quarters, but a huge uproar on the other side of the ledger here. Do they change, John? Do they withdraw, retreat?
I don't think so. I have a few points to make, but if we can't get to them now, I'll get to them after the break.
We'll come right back to them. John McCormick with the Weekly Standard, please stand by right there. Howard Fineman with the Huffington Post, please stand by. And Jack Beatty, listeners, you can join us. What about Obama, the Catholic Church, and requiring birth control coverage? Was he right to do that? And what is up with Komen and Planned Parenthood? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a wild pileup early Sunday on Florida as Interstate 75 kills 11 people, a smoky brush fire nearby, and disaster. A woman on the road described the scene to a 911 operator.
She's coming too fast. Here comes another one. Oh, yep. See? There it goes.
There it goes. It's been 50 years since One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was published. Here's author Ken Kesey, who died in 2001, reading from his iconic novel.
The patients start coming out of the dorms. By the time the patients get their eyes rubbed to where they can halfway see, all they see is the head nurse, smiling and calm and cold as usual, telling the black boys they'd best not stand in a group gossiping when there's such a lot to be done. Mean old Monday morning, you know, boys. Here's Miss Ratched.
Head Nurse Ratched. And Don Cornelius, the creator of the hippest trip in America, the TV show Soul Train, died this week by his own hand at 75. His show was legend. Soul Train. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney and Komen, Planned Parenthood, soccer riots in Egypt, and a huge death toll there. Facebook lining up for a big IPO. Howard Fineman with Huffington Post is with us. John McCormick, staff writer for the Weekly Standard, is here. And Jack Beatty, you can join us. What do you see going on with Komen and Planned Parenthood? Are you still walking for the pink after all this? And what about Obama, the administration, and the Catholic Church requiring birth control coverage? Was he right to do it? And look at Afghanistan. What's really going on there? Is the Taliban on the run, as the president says, or confident of victory, as we read in this secret NATO report? And where's the real recovery in this economy? Is the Fed right? Is it years away? Are we seeing it in 8.3% unemployment? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John McCormick, let me come to you on Susan G. Komen and Planned Parenthood.
The first point I'd make is that one reason Komen has given for taking away this funding is that Planned Parenthood does not perform the mammograms themselves on site. They make mammogram referrals, but it seems to me that actually performing the mammogram is significantly different than referring someone to another doctor. They also do breast exams.
But if they're the funnel that gets poor women or women in need to that service...
My second point would be that even if they are serving that function, there are millions of Americans. You know, half this issue divides the country about halfway down the middle on abortion. If people believe that abortion is a taking of a human life, then the fact that Planned Parenthood performs 300,000 abortions a year is going to lead those people to not want to give their charitable donations or be in any way associated. I'm one of those people. My grandmother died of breast cancer. I have given to the American Cancer Foundation since I've had a job. I've not given to the Komen Foundation because of this, and now I will start. So people are going to be divided both ways on this. And thirdly, I would say this is a significant cultural moment. You know, Planned Parenthood, the federal government has tried to defund it. But in another sense, it's actually a little insane about the amount of intensity and media coverage that this is getting. The Komen Foundation grant of $700,000 to Planned Parenthood represented not less than 1% of Planned Parenthood's budget, but less than 0.1%. Planned Parenthood has a $1 billion budget, and we, and the nightly news last night on two of the major networks led with this story.
Have you felt the intensity of people's opinions about this, John? I mean, you must have. It's not.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Activists are interested in this.
I'm way more than activist. You describe it as a cultural moment. I mean, people can feel that there is a kind of play between perspectives here that's getting really, really tough.
Like I said, it's a significant moment. But when you step back for a second, you say we are having this huge debate over $700,000 to a $1 billion organization. You're right; it's about much more than the money. Mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood could probably easily make up that. I mean, they already have. Planned Parenthood has already raised more than $700,000 in backlash. And Komen says their donations are up 100% since they announced this policy. So in terms of money, both sides are going to end up with more money. But I just think that yes, I don't want to be giving to a charity that is also help that. is subsidizing an organization that is the largest abortion practitioner in America. And I think there are half the country, maybe more than half the country, would feel that way.
Jack Beatty, all kinds of response here online. Here's one. A listener says, what the Komen story points out is how important it is to see who's behind the curtain of cause-oriented groups. Only now, after participating in many races and other pink events, do I find out the rest of the story. I guess the Komen politics here, that's the real takeaway. I mean, you can feel the tension around this, Jack, as this question, I mean, it's been acute for a long time, but it just seems to become more and more acute, and the chasm between perspectives so wide, Jack.
So wide, so intense, and yet in some ways so concentrated. For example, in the exit polls from Florida, abortion was the issue that mattered most to 7% of voters, of Republican voters, 7%. Mm. As against over 40% the economy. Now, so it's clearly an issue, but I think the question always with this is, you know, numbers. And I really disagree with what John said, half the country. That's not my reading of the data, that half the country is against choice or abortion rights. I don't think that's the case. And also, you see the position here that Komen has got into. They're pitching really to that 7%, the really intense people, and they're forgetting about the vast number on the other side who may have more to contribute, I mean, just in the crass dollar terms, than the intense, focused minority.
We've got all kinds of response online. Roy in Boise, I guess Idaho, says to the Komen Foundation, open mouth, insert foot. On the other hand, you've got people lining up and saying, well, they don't want that connection between Komen and Planned Parenthood. Buffalo, New York, Anna's calling. Hi, Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think they're all missing the boat. I'm a 47-year-old Catholic woman, but I will fight every day for the ownership of my body. That means I will fight every day for the right for other women to have abortion. And I think that all of these organizations do not address the fact that it's truly about the ownership of your body. Abortion should not be a choice that's legislated. It should be a choice made by the individual woman.
So what do you do, Anna, when it comes down to this? Here's Komen that has poured so much money into research on breast cancer, very important issue for women and their bodies. They appear to be taking a kind of stand here. Where do you end up?
It makes me sick because I have pink eyeglasses. I have supported the Komen Foundation for a very long time. But I think all of these women's organizations are truly missing the opportunity to say to young women, it's your body, it's your choice, but it's about ownership and legislation of your right to reproduce, not reproduce. I could cut off my finger. I can pierce my nose. I can do all kinds of things. But if I don't have true ownership of every aspect of my body, how free am I?
Anna, we get it loud and clear, though clearly that's not the bottom line for a lot of people pushing against that. But we hear the argument, and it's a big one. Price in Millbrook, Alabama. Price, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As related to science and technology sort of confusing morality in the evangelical stating that, it seems like they're hypocritical because there's like, well, science and technology are bad as related to abortion, but they were great when it came to keeping Terri Schiavo alive when she should have died naturally. And there was a huge argument. She stayed alive because science and technology and machines and things that would have been considered unnatural by the church, you know, until it was readily accepted. It's like anything is related to the zeitgeist. They're always against it until us as a whole, as a society, embrace it as, no, this is just part of the human condition.
Well, we're having a hard time getting consensus on this point, but I see what you mean exactly. We're going to do an entire hour on Monday on Komen and Planned Parenthood and the whole issue. I appreciate your call there from Alabama, Price. I mean, kind of related territory this week with the Obama administration pushing religious organizations to provide in their health care plans for their employees contraceptive coverage. And a lot of pushback on that. Also support. Here's a little tape. Sarah Lipton-Lovett, lawyer for the ACLU, telling NPR that she agrees with the Obama administration decision.
Taking a job at a hospital simply isn't the same thing as joining a church.
when you operate in the public sphere, you need to play by the public rules. What they're asking to do is to impose their religious beliefs on people who don't share them. The nurses, the social workers, the support staff who work at these hospitals, social service agencies, and universities.
They deserve contraceptive coverage. They'll get it under the Obama policy, but a lot of pushback in the church. David Zubik, Bishop of Pittsburgh, one of several bishops, who said that he will not follow the new law. Here he is objecting on moral grounds.
We can't comply and we won't comply. There's no way we can. It's a matter of conscience.
Howard Fineman, can you explain what happened this week with the Obama administration and this policy, and why now?
Well, they're rolling out the rules as they relate to the new health care plan, and this was something they had to do administratively. I mean, they had to reach this issue administratively as they write rules for it.
Yeah.
And I think their lawyers looked at it and said, in contrast to the bishop in Pittsburgh, my hometown, by the way, that look, if it's public money, they have to follow the public rules. But once again, you run up against this deep and fervent, and I must say politically ever more potent, fear that somehow science and the government is going to take over control of human reproduction. I was astonished, again, to go back to that conference I went to on personhood.
Mm-hmm.
The fear of the new science of DNA and genetic manipulation, and the notion that through science we will be able to take away from God the control of the creation of human beings and human destiny. It's a very deep issue. It's a very, very powerful one, and that is what's driving all of these objections. That's what's driving the bishop in Pittsburgh. That's what's driving the people who wanted to get Susan G. Komen to stop giving money to Planned Parenthood. And it's a very profound thing, and it only is something that 5 or 10% of the American public is focused on right now. But I'm telling you, this is a debate that's just beginning, and it's going to grow, and you're right to spend as much time as you can talking about it.
We're going to come back to certainly the Komen Planned Parenthood part of that on Monday. I want to pull back a little bit for a minute here. A lot going on around the globe, testimony back and forth and sideways on Afghanistan. The president, of course, said in his State of the Union speech, very high on, Taliban is sort of, he didn't say on the run, but definitely kind of receding. But then this week we had James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, on Capitol Hill. Here he is concurring with Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss when he told the Senate Intelligence Committee that the Taliban in Afghanistan remains a formidable enemy.
Our assessment is pretty much as you stated it, sir. The Taliban remains a resilient, determined adversary.
And reports this week of high officials in the Afghan government already cutting their deals with the Taliban as the U.S. talks about pulling troops out, pulling out of a frontline combat role, moving into a more advisory role. Here's White House Press Secretary Jay Carney sort of looking to downplay some of Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's comments about U.S. combat forces starting to leave in mid-2013.
What Secretary Panetta said is that it could happen that the transition to Afghan security lead could be moved up to 2013, but he was not making an announcement about a decision that had been made.
Jack Beattie, a lot of dancing and diverse views of what's really going on in Afghanistan the last couple of weeks.
Yes, yesterday's story in the New York Times about a leaked NATO report about the state of the Taliban, based on 27,000 interrogation of 4,000 Taliban and other captives. Basically, it comes to the conclusion the Taliban are confident of victory. And they're just, as people have been saying all along, waiting us out. They have already made deals with people high in the government, perhaps, but certainly low in the provinces. And their relations with Pakistan, despite some tensions through the Pakistan Intelligence Service, that goes on. And this is not the picture the president conveyed in his State of the Union message. And it's so clear that this whole Afghanistan issue has been a political issue for the president. Damningly, in Bob Woodward's book, a military aide to the president, General Light, is quoted saying that the president dealt with the military about the you know, his escalation in Afghanistan the way you would with a pressure group. What do I have to do to buy them off? I think what he had to do to buy off David Petraeus was give him these 30,000 men. Let's talk about nation building. Let's talk about counterinsurgency. And this farce went on for over a year, and now we're backing out of it. Now that the politics have changed, the president is accelerating the timetable to get. It just seems to me this whole venture for the president has been driven by politics in its lowest key.
Well, he's up against it. It certainly factors into politics, and it may not be the only conflict that factors into politics. Howard Fineman, this week we've got Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, saying, he said just yesterday that Israel could launch attacks against Iran as early as April or May. To stop Tehran from building a nuclear bomb. I mean, that would be huge in so many dimensions, not least in internally, Howard, in this country's politics.
Oh, it would be explosive in every conceivable way. First of all, you got on the Republican side, you've got all the Republican candidates except Ron Paul, significantly, except for Ron Paul. All the others are falling all over themselves to be more hawkish than the last guy on the whole question of what to do about Iran, and they are supporting Israel all the way and painting Iran in the most dangerous and fraught terms. So that's the pressure on the Republican side. In terms of the geopolitics of it, which I know less about, I think that the supporters of Israel and people in Israel themselves don't take a lot of stock in and don't trust the president, and they don't trust the Democratic administration. So Barack Obama probably has less leverage over the Israelis than some other presidents and administrations in the past. And it's a very, very dangerous situation, and I have no idea where it's headed, but it doesn't look like it's headed in a very good direction.
John McCormick, do you see the GOP ready to kind of stand up, salute, support Israel in attacking Iran if Panetta's right, if that's where we are in April or May? Or they
I think
are.
If it comes to it, I think if it comes down to that, the GOP probably will. Obviously, that's kind of fraught with a lot of danger. But the question is whether Iran is a typical state that can be deterred through conventional means, as the Soviet Union was, or is it so fanatical that it would actually use these weapons, or at the very least use them, obviously, to bully Israel into concessions?
Jack, I mean, one hates to see a kind of inexorability click in again here. We've been down this road before in Iraq. Different circumstances, but I don't know. What are you feeling, Jack?
Oh, it's very frightening. I am somewhat heartened by the view that the leak that General Dempsey, our Joint Chiefs of Staff, had told the Israelis when he was there a couple of weeks ago that they would be on their own if they now will the administration if God help us they do attack would what would that mean, be on your own? Does that deter them? We don't know.
Talk about white knuckles. Wow. Howard Fineman, editorial director of the AOL Huffington Post Media Group. Always great to have you, Howard. Thank you for being here today.
Delighted. Thanks.
John McCormick with the Weekly Standard. John, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.